It is chapter 1, verses 14 through 17. You can follow along on page 152. I am a debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. Hence my eagerness to proclaim the gospel to you also who are in Rome. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is powerful of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in the righteousness of God is revealed, through faith for faith, as it is written, the one who is righteous will live by faith.
Series through the following the narrative lectionary. So we spent the fall from Genesis on through the minor prophets of the Old Testament before turning to Matthew. This is the last sermon in that run, number 37 in our walk through the Bible. It's been rewarding for me just to step back and take a look at this wider scope of Scripture. And we end today with an explanation and a defense of the gospel. Martin Lloyd-Jones was the longtime pastor of Westminster Chapel in London, and he was well known in one-on-one conversations with people about faith to ask them a simple question: are you now ready to say that you are a Christian? He could ask that question to people who had never set foot within a church in their life, and he could ask it to people who had been in church every Sunday since the Sunday after they were born. The question worked equally well for both groups. Are you now ready to say that you are a Christian? It offers a great entryway to talk about the essential qualities of the gospel, including whether or not we trust in Jesus alone for our salvation, or if we are trying to measure our value in God's sight by the things either that we have done or the things that we have not done, as the case may be. Being a Christian is about a change in our relationship with God based on the work of Christ on the cross and nothing else. And it is this question that lies behind Paul's monumental letter to the Romans. Paul's entire life was characterized by ambitions that are every bit as big as the God that he serves. And so if God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him would not perish but have eternal life. And if Jesus had instructed the disciples to go and make disciples of all nations, then Paul was determined to see that done. And although he had not yet gotten to take his trip to Rome, and he would only do so later as a prisoner, Paul was determined that the gospel of Jesus Christ would have a strong footing in the capital city of the empire. He wanted to see a thriving congregation of people whose lives had been transformed by the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they were acting out of that transformation in all of their relationships with everybody with whom they came into contact. And so Paul writes to the Christians living in Rome a letter outlining the basics of the Christian faith, the gospel message and its implications for all people, Jew and Gentile alike, as it impacts our understanding about God for ourselves and for our daily lives. And he does this, and in this letter he does what we attempt to do every Sunday, proclaim Jesus Christ declared to be the Son of God by resurrection from the dead. So we find in the letter to the Romans that Paul is doing in dense theological explanation what Matthew did in story and what Luke did in history in the text we've looked at every Sunday since, including and following since Easter Sunday. He's reaching back into the most fundamental problem that the Bible describes and offering a solution for it. It's something that we've been aware of since our walk through the narrative lectionary began last September. The fundamental problem outlined by the opening chapter of Genesis: sin has fundamentally corrupted the relationship that God intended to have with us. And from that corruption, every other relationship in our lives has become corrupted as well. Ever since the beginning of our broken relationship with God, it has led all of our other relationships to become broken. We've become socially alienated from one another as our continual pursuit of our own interests leads to inevitable conflict with other persons. We have become psychologically alienated from ourselves as shame and fear are constant motivating factors in our decision-making. Those of you who are in Sunday school with Mike and I this morning, just think about the episode of the Andy Griffith we watched. It's all there, this alienation from other people because we're not at peace with ourselves. And we've become physically alienated from creation, viewing the world as a perpetually renewable, eternal source of life, when in fact our own attempts to dominate the creation are damaging it and ruining the life that it supports. We see this kind of alienation all around us. Last Tuesday evening, I attended a meeting with a room full of other leaders in the city of Roanoke, talking about the way that citizens and agencies and other leaders in the city might work together to reduce the rise of gun violence within our city. Each one of these people, educators, healthcare providers, social workers, some other pastors, counselors, police officers, people who are mentors, each one has made it their career to invest themselves into other people's lives. And people went around the room. We spent almost 2 hours just introducing ourselves and talking about what brought us to the conversation that evening and what the challenge of gun violence looks like from their perspective. Some listed drug use and addiction. Others mentioned broken homes, especially the absence of strong, healthy men in the role of their sons' lives. Some described people who have never known any response to a problem other than revenge and retaliation. Some are concerned with ready access to guns and the capacity of modern weapons to inflict crippling damage on those who survive. Others talked about suicide. Still others spoke of the impact gun violence has on family members of those who commit crimes with guns. As I left the meeting last Tuesday evening, I realized that I had just spent 2 hours in a conversation about the spiritual formation of our city. That we had talked about the soul of Roanoke for 2 hours from a variety of perspectives, each one bringing their perspective, their lens through which they see this place in which we live. Now, it just so happened that I'd been invited to participate in this conversation on gun violence, but I would suggest to you that we could pick any other topic and collect a group of people, talk about it for a couple of hours, and realize we'd done the same thing. We had talked about the spiritual formation of the place in which we live simply through another lens. And we would come to some interesting conclusions about it. There is a spiritual formation that is always at work on our lives. And the problem with the spiritual formation that the world offers to us is that it is born out of corruption and brokenness. It is born out of this fact that our lives were broken because of sin. And if we give it free rein in our lives, then it will form us after a broken image. We need a different kind of spiritual formation to shape us into the image of Christ. And that is what Paul is talking about in his letter to the Romans, the good news of the gospel. Jesus Christ raised from the dead, seated at the right hand of the Father in heaven, and offering to forgive us and welcome us back into right relationship with God. This is the spiritual formation that ought to be primary in our lives. There we will find a spiritual formation that answers the brokenness of the world. So when Paul writes to a congregation of believers who live in Rome about 20 or so years after the resurrection, he is writing to people who are in many ways like us. They live in a place where they have access to all of the possibilities and the privileges that come by living close to the power center of the empire. Rome is the capital. But what we also have in common with them is that the language and values of the church and the language and values of the culture are on increasingly divergent paths. It's an issue that I don't think today's church, speaking broadly, has always wanted to address. But as time goes on, the values that we proclaim here in the church, that Jesus Christ is Lord, that we seek the interests of others ahead of our own needs, that we love our enemies, that we honor our marriage commitments, that we are stewards, not owners of our possessions. Values like these seem increasingly rare in the world around us. And I feel will become even more increasingly rare as time goes on. You see, the gospel presents us with a significant tension that exists between two points: my will be done or thy will be done. Which in our lives will it be? Jesus teaches us in the Lord's Prayer to pray, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And then later in the gospel, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus is essentially wrestling with, will he be the answer to the prayer? Will he do what he's taught us to pray when his whole life is on the line? Will he pray, "Thy will be done"? Will his life reflect, "Thy will be done"? Or will, but we are continually surrounded by temptations and impulses that teach us to say, "No, my will be done in life," and let our lives revolve around those things which seems best to us. Now, we're not all lost here, because Horace is preaching about the Garden of Gethsemane next Sunday. So I'm going to leave the rest of the heavy lifting on that point to him and look forward to the audio recording when I return. But in significant measure, I would suggest that those of you who are over 70 years old, lived in a time, grew up in a time, when you could count on the fact that Christians and non-Christians shared a set of basic moral convictions, that the world operated in some ways very similar to the way the church operated. I mean, it used to be that when a congregation, especially one in the country, would hold revival services, not only would the whole congregation come, even sinners came to revival. Even people who had no interest in the church, their other 51 weeks of the year, would show up at revival. I've been told stories of churches where they would open the windows in the side and the crowd would all be there listening in from the outside. Now, they weren't coming to hear the gospel. They were coming because there wasn't a whole lot else going on in town, and this is where everybody was. But they were at least within arm's reach of the gospel. But not so much. Or as I shared a few Sundays ago, when I was growing up, even my next-door neighbors, who were wonderful neighbors, great people and friends of our family for a long time, but simply weren't church folk, knew that you didn't cut the grass on Sunday. That was just something in my growing up, as we talked the other Sunday, you just didn't do. And even folks who didn't go to church knew that. There was this shared set of assumptions on what was right and what was wrong. But no more. No more. Perhaps the biggest challenge facing the church in our generation is that this consensus on moral conviction is gone and is replaced with an attitude that we should work all these things out for ourselves. My will be done, not thy will be done. And it is to a culture like ours that Paul writes this letter to the Romans, saying to them, "I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God to salvation for everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith, as it is written, 'The one who is righteous will live by faith.'" Paul wants the Romans to know that God is answering the fundamental problem of the world, how the gospel will bring people back into right relationship with God, and then by extension into right relationship with everything else around them. That God has bigger things in mind than a wonderful plan for your life or your best life now, to borrow a few popular phrasings of the gospel these days. The gospel Paul proclaims is about more than reordering our private spiritual lives, cleaning up a morally dysfunctional mess via forgiveness that exists only in our heads but never makes it to our heart, to our hands, and to our feet. This news about Jesus is that the fundamental operating system of the world has been defeated and everything has been summoned to give allegiance to Jesus Christ. We have been invited to participate in this new ordering of life and allegiance and trust. The question that Martin Lloyd-Jones asked people in his day is still relevant. Are you now ready to say that you are a Christian? One way you might answer this is by exploring the word ashamed. Paul says he's not ashamed of the gospel. We might ask ourselves what we're ashamed of in life and start there. What are the things that make you ashamed of? Things you're embarrassed about or reluctant to do because of your own or someone else's actions or choices or attitudes. And in that moment when you might be ashamed, What is your prayer? My will be done, or thy will be done? Which is it? It occurred to me to think about a person who is being bullied and is ashamed by it. Now, it's easy to think that we're talking about kids at that point, but not so fast. It could be any of us. And when we're the one in that position, one of the things we have to decide is, who is defining my self-worth and my self-control? This other person who has figured out a way to make me feel less about myself than I should, or Christ, or my church family, this phone book thick relationship that we have with one another that is not so easily damaged? Well, that can be tough to work out at any age, right? Don't leave this question just to the youth department. This one's for all of us. It can be tough to work that out. But it won't be, I think, until we're confident of our self-identity that we won't respond to the bully, that we won't be able to respond to the bully in the manner of Jesus. We've got to work out in whom we've placed our most value, where we're finding our source of self-worth. Then we'll be able to work out how to respond to that one that wants to do us harm. Somebody else wants us to be too ashamed to stand up for ourselves in some way. Are we ashamed of a gospel that invites us to love our neighbor as we love ourselves? What does it mean to love ourselves? It's a crucial part of that question. Or maybe you're the person or family who has somehow found themselves living financially at 125% of your average income because you've bought into the idea that life has to reflect a certain image. But now you want out to a sustainable level of living, and so that you can honor Jesus with your finances as well as the rest of your life. Well, that might mean laying down some important things. Well, are we ashamed of a new image, a new appearance to the world around us? The New Testament is filled with people who in some way or another were ashamed of something. It's one way to look at the encounters that Jesus had with people. What were these people ashamed of? What was causing them shame? And how did they respond? How did Jesus help them deal with it? Some had diseases that left them struggling to survive on the fringes of society, and they wanted back in. They wanted to be part of the community again. Others had a burning dissatisfaction with life and recognized that there was more than going on than what they had been able to do for themselves could provide. They needed rescue and hope. And in Jesus, those persons were presented with the hope of the gospel, realizing that Jesus' love for them was not based on who others said that they were or what they had done. Now, if we could just figure that out, we'd be miles down the road, wouldn't we? That our self-worth is not determined by what others think of us or by what we ourselves have even done. That there is another way of calculating our self-worth, our value as human beings. We are also broken that Jesus died for us. But we are also loved that Jesus willingly did it. That in the Garden of Gethsemane, he ultimately said, "Thy will be done." We were brought back into God's family, and now our lives are filled with gratitude as a divine reordering has taken place within us. And so the question now for each one of us remains, are you now ready to say, "You are a Christian"? Are we ready to say that? Amen.